The monumental part of it was hearing Steve Lukather. I hadn't heard this kind of energy coming from the electric guitar.
What was the evolution to realizing that that was the perfect sound?
George Harrison's solo on I Saw Her Standing There.
Did your son influence this?
I worked with Simon Phillips. I worked with Olivia Newton-John.
Why do you have to go so far away to tour?
It's a long commute, man.
This episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gators got you covered. All right, Andy, thanks for being here.
Oh, man, great to be with you, Zach.
Okay, you have said in a couple interviews that one of the most monumental songs for you is Breakdown Dead Ahead, Boss Skaggs. What do you love about that song?
It wasn't necessarily, well, the song is great, but the monumental part of it was hearing Steve Lukather. It was a moment in time, at least in my, how I think of it chronologically, it was right about the time I started hearing Luke with Toto. So I don't know if it's 77 or 78, but somewhere in that time frame, Hold the Line was getting radio airplay, but then this other song, Breakdown Dead Ahead, and I was like, who the heck is this? You know, and it was some kind of... I mean, that's completely, I don't know the solo, but that's a... I hadn't heard this kind of energy coming from the electric guitar quite like that. So again, no offense to Boss Skaggs and no offense to Breakdown Dead Ahead, but it wasn't necessarily the song, it was the guitar player on it. But it's a cool pop FM radio rock tune.
Aren't those slides, I feel like that's so Lukather and then later Dan Huff, like that is so him, right?
Yeah, it is. Well, for me initially, yes, but then if you go back and hear Larry Carlton, I mean, there's a lot of things that Larry was doing before, you know, Dan and Luke, but it's the way they put it together. It's like anything else when you look at the Stevie Ray Vaughan and what he got from Hendrix and Albert King, you know, you can trace the lineage, but then they make it their own and put it out there in a certain way that just really hadn't been done with the type of conviction and tone. And that's what it was for Luke for me, because I hadn't heard Carlton yet. A couple years later, would hear Room 335, that record, his solo record. And that was another epiphany. There was a lot of epiphanies at this time, because it's in 78, I guess I'm like 15, you know, 16 years old, really playing well, good straight ahead rock and roll. But I was coming from the 70s arena rock. It was all Kiss and Nugent, Rush, Foghat, REO, Speedwagon. Great foundation. But then I hear guys that are kind of bringing more to the table. And that was, you know, with Lukather, with the some of the bend. Some wider bends and just, but it was his time feel and where he put things. And then there's later some chromaticisms that start happening. So it was kind of, you know, searching for new pathways to take me further, because I was starting to listen to jazz. You know, my first guitar teacher at the age of 16 was turning me on to all the great classic jazz players. He was a big Barney Kessel fan. So I was getting some of that information. So I started hearing some of the rock guys drawing from some of that, and I realized eventually that, you know, it could all be put together. And then when I heard Mike Stern a couple of years later, it's like, well, there it is, that's the next level, you know. But yeah, the Breakdown Dead Ahead thing is certainly because of my hero and buddy Luke, you know.
But when you heard that solo that you point out, like, did you learn it note by note, and then did that make you explore other records that Lukather was on? Because I've heard you mention this song on a couple interviews.
Well, yeah, so no, it literally became, especially like by the time I got down to Miami, which would have been 83, I'd already, you know, it was a game of just finding anything with Lukather's name in the credits and buying that record. As little as that. Now, I didn't learn a lot of solos note for note, you know, I might have gotten a lick. But with a lot of things, I mean, there was a bit of that, but I was kind of lazy. I would take the energy in some of the ideas and just kind of starting integrating it into my own, whatever I was doing, you know. Very fortunately, I mean, from the age of 13, I'd been in a band, and still to this day, I guess I could say I've never not been in a band. I was always gigging. So whatever information I was getting influenced by, I was in a band playing three nights a week or four nights a week live, so I'd be implementing these things. But I wasn't like a great, you know, transcriber, practicer. You know, I learned a lot of Kiss, you know, solos note for note, or some of the early rock stuff I would have been getting into. So I mean, it wasn't particular licks, but just the energy and the ideas behind it. I think that, and that's a healthy thing. You know, you can go both paths and get just as much. And I do later on, I got much better at transcribing and really learning things a bit more note for note when I found it, you know, was necessary, might be beneficial.
Hey, real quick, if you want some of the licks that Andy Timmons is playing in this interview, check out my Patreon. Everything's tabbed out, ready to go, linked in the pinned comment. All right, on with the interview.
I don't understand, though, because when I look at players like you and I go, how do I get to a level like Andy Timmons? What comes to my mind is that I need to transcribe more. But that's not really what you spend most of your time doing.
I spent my time playing. And so I know it's a weird thing to say because you have to learn in order to be able to play. And I mean, obviously transcribing is hugely valuable. It's just, it's down to the discipline of the player, I think, and the personality and the makeup of how they function and how they process information. You know, my son who started playing when he was 16, he's 21 now, is a really killer, like heavy, he's on a death metal band, you know? And I tried at certain points to get him to like, here's some pentatonic scale. He just had no interest in any of it. And I went, oh man, this is going to be really useful for him later. But I hear stuff coming out of his room that I have no idea how he's doing it. And I'll go in and ask him. He'll go, well, I don't know. But so there's certain things about transcribing and theory that can be very, very beneficial, but it can also be detrimental as far as inhibiting you. Like, well, here's the parameters and you have to stay in these lines, you know. I think a balance is what's really healthy. So, but for me, I was never a good practicer per se, but I was always playing. So in that way, that's practicing, of course, because nothing replaces fingers on the frets. That's where your tone gets solidified, your time gets solidified. And learning enough along the way to get by and, you know, but yeah, I was frequently learning things ish. You know, I remember when I first formed the Andy Timmons Band in 1988, I didn't have any original material. But so we were doing like, you know, Cliffs of Dover and Satch Boogie and Attitude Song. And they would be very ish. You know, I wasn't the kind of guy that's got to sound exactly like Eric Johnson. Now if I attempted to play those songs, I'd get murdered online. Like, he's not even close, you know. But that's not how I approached it. I just wanted to, you know, there were great tunes. Let me play the tunes and I'll put my own flavor on it, you know?
Right. How did your sound of delay that you always have with the halo, that quarter with the dotted eighth, what was the evolution to realizing that that was the perfect combination of sound that you needed?
Yeah, it's a long path because I'd always been enamored with a really wet guitar sound, starting with George Harrison's solo on I Saw Her Standing There. It was just that Studio 3, the room that they had, the tile room with the microphones in it, not tile, but concrete with pillars. But they would generate, you know, sound into the room and capture the verb and put that on the sound. So I'd always been enamored with a wet sound for whatever reason. And some of those Lukather solos, there's lots of delay. All Along the Watchtower solo. I love a great delay drenched kind of tone. And as I, you know, was establishing more and more of my own sound and style, I recognized that the right combination of echo and modulation can really give you, it's almost like a sustain pedal. I can hold a note. Get a decent sound. Hello, where'd my sound go? You know, if I didn't have the echo, but the actual dotted eighth quarter thing came. I've been from my earliest band. We had a Roland Space Echo for the PA, but I would always put it on my guitar rig and steal it. Then when I could afford it, I bought an Ibanez AD202, which was a rack unit analog multi effects. It had a phaser and a flanger, a core, maybe a chorus and an echo. So I always had that on. And when I got a Rockman, you know, when the Tom Scholz Rockman came out in 19, whatever it was, early 80s, it's like, wow, you sound like the record. So I could put my guitar into the Rockman, into the 8202. And I had a Music Man combo amp with a 15 inch speaker. So that was my tone into a Rockman, into this delay, into the, so there's echo on the Rockman, or tighter, but a multi-repeat. And then I had the 8202, and it was a magical sound. It really sounded beautiful. And so, I mean, I just kind of kept going from unit to unit. But when I was working with Simon Phillips on a record, we did several records from the 90s forward, and he had a dotted eighth quarter patch on this little Boss SC70 half rack delay unit that he would always use on his guitar synth patches when he's making demos. He put that on my guitar and said, like, "Yeah, that's great." He says, "Oh yeah, I got that from David Gilmour. He uses that dotted eighth quarter, I guess, maybe when they were working in the studio on the White City album." So I just kind of started adapting that as my general, "Oh, dotted eighth quarter, that's cool." I was never that time specific with it, but if I had, I'd usually set up like a 500 millisecond and a 375 millisecond. And I would do similar things in the studio. When we did the Resolution record back in 2006, I was using a tape echo. I had a tube tape echo by Fuller, Full Tone, and an original Maestro EP3. And I had a Chandler digital delay, which actually is a real early digital that sounded great. But I would set them thusly, kind of 500, 375-ish, but non-specific to the tune, because when I would get the echoes right, you know, they weren't so much in the way, you know, hearing the actual and all the rhythmic, but if the great thing about a great sounding tape echo is the way the echoes stay out of the way and then kind of just feather away into kind of turn into a reverb. And so that was always kind of what I was striving for with other, you know, pedal and rack gear, because the tape echoes are pretty volatile and take a lot of maintenance, which I'm not good at. So, you know, eventually I stumbled onto, probably by recommendation, the old Electro Harmonix Memory Man. So I was using two of those in series, and that further kind of gave me part of what I was going for, because they both had, you know, the old units had modulation available, but just on the repeats. So if I dial it in just right, the repeats go just slightly out of tune. Right at the end, they'll just barely go out of tune, and that's kind of like a nice piece of tape that's just worn out and not. And those preamps in there, it was a really nice kind of murky, lovely reverb it would turn into. And of course, those old units were kind of volatile and kept breaking down. So I started using the Strymon Timeline, which is a great, great unit. And I sat for days trying to get the Strymon to sound like the old Memory Men. And I always called it like 91%, got it really close, and that unit is great, but it does 1,000 things. And that's when I started thinking, man, if I could collaborate with somebody and just get this one thing that I really love, you know, I'd be so happy. And I went to Daniel Steinhardt, the guy that builds my pedal board Gig Rig G3 switching system, from that pedal show, Daniel Steinhardt. And he says, "Oh, Robert Keeley, that's your guy." And so it was at an AM show. So he introduced us, and it was about 3 years later that we now have the Halo. So it's my signature, you know. I'm not sure if you're hearing it in stereo, probably not. If you were to hear it in stereo. So it's kind of my always on, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just giving me this space, and I can elongate notes when I want and kind of sing a certain way.
I feel like the number one thing that you constantly say in all your demos with this pedal is you go, it's not a reverb, it's a delay. You're clear to make that distinction.
Yes.
What do you think is the distinction in terms of the outer sound where the delay starts to sound like reverb? And is it better to get that effect with delay versus just having a thick reverb on it?
You could have a thick reverb. You know, I don't know, because I've never gotten a verb yet to do it the way that I hear it. You know, it's just a matter of just trying to, you know, be in a room with Robert and his genius team to try to feel what it is that we're going for. And that's what it took a year and a half of us getting together, listening to my tape echoes, to the Memory Man, and all the different ways I was generating the sound and getting it close. And even those guys are like, "Man, it sounds like a reverb." Okay, so, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't any level of genius. I'm just kind of setting, you know, tweaking as best I could with each unit to get it to do what I wanted to do. But they started to really kind of hear what I was going after and how it was happening. And it's just something about the way those echoes degrade, you know, with each repeat. And if you're feeding two, you know, into each other. So again, you're not hearing that. Such the specifics.
Right.
But there's a brilliant function within the halo that Robert developed in order to attain this. And it's a deep edit called saturation. It's just a way of distorting and compressing some of the issues, some of the repeats there. That I don't think has been done quite in that way before. But you mentioned the reverb, and we are working on a reverb, but it's not going to be, you know, achieved in the way that most reverbs are achieved. So stay tuned for that, because I think it's possible even without the delays. So to get this sound that I'm going for, and then not even have those repeats at all. Right. So we'll see.
Andy, you've been so busy this year already. We're only a couple months in. The new album, Recovery, starts off with this great tribute to Jeff Beck. Why did you feel like you had to start off the record that way?
Well, he's such a important figure to so many of us. And in the world of guitar, there's just this, if there's ever a Mount Rushmore, you know, he would have been on there already with Shapes of Things back in 1965. But as he continued to evolve and just give us so much, you know, hope, really, there's just so much beauty and hope in what he's doing. What I mean by that is that, you know, there's always so much farther to go. He refused to repeat himself, you know. He really kept evolving, you know. And if any artist looks at their own career, I think that's what they're hoping to do if they care about that. You know, there may be some people that develop a sound and then kind of stay there their career, and there's zero wrong with that if that's what makes them happy. But I think Jeff is a kindred spirit for me, because I might be proud in the moment of my work, but it was okay, what's next? I want to keep going. I want to keep improving. I like being a student. I like knowing that I'm a beginner. I truly feel every day like, all right, I got a long way to go, you know, because there's Jeff Beck, because there's Alan Holdsworth or XY, whoever, Wes Montgomery, you know, all these geniuses that have come before us that say, hey man, there's a lot possible. You just have to keep pushing your own envelope and be the best version of yourself. That's an important thing to point out that I like to talk about, is realizing you're not going to be Jeff Beck. Don't try to be Jeff, but learn from the process and get some isms. You know, that's like what I got from Lukather for some, I stole more from him than anybody. And I tell him all that every time I'm ever around him, he goes, no, you sound like you, man. Yeah, but I'm standing on your shoulders, buddy, you know. But for Jeff, you know, to do that for Jeff and to have a piece of music, it was really sad when he died, because I thought he was going to be around another 20 years to keep me, because he just kept growing, you know. And he'd just been in Texas, and I missed him because I had a gig in Houston. When he was in Dallas, I was out of town, so I couldn't see him. But I have seen him, you know, a good handful of times since 1999, and every time it was really, really emotional and inspiring. And so that's why it just felt right to start the record with that piece, Elegy for Jeff, which is just a real simple, you know, little melody for. You know, a little bit of tremolo in there, a la Jeff. But he's missed, but he left us so much hope and inspiration. So God bless him.
There's a great song on the record, Love Greater Than Hate. There's almost at parts in it, you almost play this like thrash metal riff it almost sounds like Metallica or something. Did your son influence this that you mentioned earlier?
You know,
where'd you come up with
it? That's the thing. I have to think that, and you're the first person to maybe draw that parallel. There's no doubt, because before he's into the really heavy stuff, but when he first started getting into guitar, which again would have been in 2019, 2020, it was all Metallica and Megadeth with Marty, and a lot of Pantera, Slipknot. So yeah, it, you know. And not conscious, but I was probably drawing from that energy, you know, of what I was hearing come out of his bedroom. But it's the dichotomy of that tune, the good versus evil kind of idea. And that was a very sweet thing that somebody else pointed out in an interview last week, was that he said, like, so much of the music on the record is there's so many different moods. There's always some darkness and some sadness, but there's always hope, and there's always redemption in some way. And that is kind of how we have to feel at this time, this moment in time, you know, and in general, with just being a human being and being, if if you're a particularly sensitive human being, yeah, it can be tough, man. So, but that song is very much a dichotomy. And so there's, I think there's some really beautiful moments, but then there's some pretty heavy stuff too. So yeah, must be from Hetfield, you know.
I would imagine it is so great to have a son who's into this, and then you can be like the cool dad who gives him gear or advice or whatever. Like, is he really into this? Like, this has got to be the greatest thing, Andy, to have him playing guitar.
It is kind of cool. And what I love about it is that his thing is so contrapuntal to mine, you know. It's still rock, but it's so heavy. And he's got a great tone, but it's a whole different thing than what I do. But he's got a Mesa rectifier for, you know, 412, and he uses a PV 6505 and sometimes a rectifier head. But he had a show yesterday. There was a big you know, multi-band show yesterday in Dallas, and Bolt Cutter was the headliner. So he was thrilled about opening for one of his favorite bands. But I was there on stage helping him set up, you know. So right now they don't have a bass player, so he sets up a dual rig, and he's got my old, I have this PV stereo 120 power amp, like the heaviest power amp ever. That when I was in Danger, used to power my stage rig with preamps, and I had this power. So he used that to power a second side to his rig, you know. So I'm up there on stage helping him get his tone, getting the balance. So, you know, considering my narrow scope of knowledge and ability in life, thank goodness he chose guitar, because it's the one thing I can help him with. You know, it's like, and when he said, you know, when he came to me when he was 16, he said, "Dan, I think I want to play guitar." I said, "Well, you're in a good house. I'll help however I can." But like I mentioned, when I started trying to teach him whatever I could, maybe it's a bit of father son. He wanted his own path, and he gets what he gets from, you know, either learning by ear or watching YouTube. Like so many young players, there's so much information available. So I got to say, him going on his own path was phenomenal, because what he's writing is very original and very much his own thing. So, but I'm, you know, I help him at every stage if I feel like he could use some advice, but he does come to me for certain things for sure. So it's a lot of fun.
Andy, you're about to be off touring in Asia. You've got a bunch of sold out shows. Why do you have to go so far away to tour?
It's a long commute, man. It's a long commute. Yeah. You know, it's weird. It's just the way the career's gone. A lot of it's just been opportunity and invitation. There's in Danger, we first went to Japan in 1990. And then I went many more times for, you know, because I've been Ibanez and Dorsey, and they're based in Japan. So there were opportunities there. I worked with Simon Phillips. I worked with Olivia Newton-John. You know, clinic tours for Mesa Boogie and for Ibanez. And then, of course, my own band. So I've been to Japan more than any other country. I think this will be my 22nd time, I think. And then, you know, in Europe, I have an Italian-based kind of promoter, a fan that turned into a promoter. So we were just never the band that got in the van in the States and, you know, and did that kind of thing. My career has been a little weird in that way, but I'm happy with the balance, but I would like to play more in the States for sure. I mean, we go up to New York and play the Iridium, and there's spot gigs here and there in Texas, of course. So I think there's room for improvement there, you know, so we'll get that sussed out.
How do you fly with your number one guitar that you're holding right now, your AT-100?
I hold it right like I am right now. I don't part with it. So, I mean, there's people that buy these nice check-in road cases and whatnot, but there's always that chance that somebody's going to lose it. And that happens, or it gets stolen, you know. So it's a daily battle. Most airline folks, to a point, are very happy to help if they can. So just being kind and explaining, you know, the importance of your instrument. Most people are very, very accommodating. Sometimes they have to put it, you know, hand check it or whatever. I've had a couple of really bad experiences, but most overall it's gone very well. So I do carry a gig bag and carry it with me. And like I say, most of the times they're accommodating.
Andy, my number one guitar right behind me, I am so close to doing a refret on it, and I've crowned them so many times, and the frets have gone so low, and I'm so scared. And you have refret this guitar, you say, 8-9 times.
We think it's 9. We're not 100% sure.
When you did that the first time, did it scare you shitless? Or like
Every time.
How do you every do it? Time it does send so. It to?
Well, there's been three different guys that have done the refrets, all here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Sam Swank, who's been a long time, great friend, luthier. Jim McCandless, another guy that's done several of them, has recently passed away. And Daniel Kirkland, who's is the staff luthier repairman at the Guitar Sanctuary, which is basically my neighborhood guitar shop. It just happens to be one of the best in the country. So he did the most recent refret. So the first time he'd refretted it, he'd been doing a lot of work for me, but it was an act of faith for me to let go, because this guitar is 31 years old. I've been playing it for half of my life. I'm 61. So, you know, half of my life, this has been my main guitar. And Sam, my original luthier, says, you know, one day the next is going to turn to dust. I'm like, all right. But until it does, and he refretted it right before we did 2 weeks in Europe. And like literally the week before he refretted it, because I knew, man, this is going to be a hard tour if I don't do this. They were gone. And it turned out it's maybe the best refret so far. And I had a great time. Everything, you know, sang the way I was hoping it would. So, but you never know. And I've got other versions that obviously this is the prototype, but there's been plenty of production models that I have that maybe even sound better. But there's an intimacy that comes with being on one instrument. You just know it so well. You know, let's hope it keeps going for a while.
Andy, we're running out of time here. Anything that's been unsaid, the new album Recovery is out now. He just wrapped up a tour of Italy. He's about to be in Asia, touring his butt off. Has anything been unsaid that we haven't covered?
Well, I hope people get a chance to check out the record. It's a part two of a record that we did with Josh Smith. Not really part two, but the second record with Josh, who produced the Electric Truth record. But I kind of stepped more in an R&B bluesy direction on that one. This current record, Recovery, still the same Josh at the helm producing and helping me arrange, and the same core band. More rock, but there's a great diversity in the tones. There's a lot of vintage Strat tones on the record. There's, of course, this guitar, the ATZ, my newer mahogany body guitar. This is on Love is Greater Than Hate and Recovery. So really happy with the sounds and the tunes. I'm going to be recording the solo piece record, the Outlier Nocturnes, which pieces like Here Lies the Heart and things like that. And just real simple. We're going to record that in the next couple of months when I get back. And then the next Andy Timmons band record, working on that. So lots more to come. But thank you guys for always tuning in and checking out the sounds, checking out the tunes. And keep playing. That's the only way to get the tone and the playing better, you know, just keep doing it.
Absolutely. Can you play us out with a little anything, a little Noodle or Sergeant Pepper song, anything?
Ooh, Sergeant Pepper's. She's leaving home.
I love hearing you do that. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time. You are the master. Thank you so much.
Work in progress, man. Keep going.
Absolutely. See you next time. Thank you.
Cheers,
thank
Jack.
You.
Thank you so much, Zach.